Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September 20th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is John DeGraff. Today's session, Television and Social Change, The Bread of Life. Let's listen in.
And particularly in Mexico and other places that John Jevons had come up with in order to help people feed themselves, the poorest of the poor, begin to feed themselves. So I'm going to show this program about, again, remember that this was made in 1987, and now what in the film you'll see has extended to Mexico has now extended to many countries, and John's book, which is described then as having been translated at that time and been translated only, I think, into Spanish and French, has now been translated into about 30 different languages. And is used everywhere. And I think it's just the story. John has been a friend of mine ever since we first met. He lives in Willits, California. And it's just the story of what one person with a passion to do something really can accomplish by sticking to it and following their dream. So this is called Circle of Plenty. Might have a little bit of a
He's probably 10 to 15 years ahead of his time, but his time is coming.
I am convinced of the viability of this method. It's quite clear that it is productive and it is our hope for the future.
John Jevons is a master gardener and a man with a mission.
What we're going to be able to do is use our units of water and fertilizer and soil 10 times more efficiently than is being done now.
For 15 years, Jevons and several associates have been testing and perfecting what they call biointensive agriculture. It's an organic gardening technique capable of producing crop yields much higher than those of modern commercial farming. The Willits Garden Project, known as Common Ground, attracts visitors from all over the world. The center of the garden is a thickly planted 1,000-square-foot circle.
This is the area that we believe minimally you can grow one complete balanced vegetarian diet in, or on the average.
This circle covers only 1/40th of an acre. American commercial farming now requires 10 times that much land to grow a complete diet. Some third world countries need 30 times as much. And many of those countries are running out of arable land. John Jevons and his fellow gardeners enjoy homegrown meals half the world would envy. Jevons once worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development. He realized then that unless ways were found to grow more food on less land, millions of people faced a future of famine. The famines have come, sweeping across drought-stricken Africa, carried by television into American living rooms. In 1984, 45 million people died of hunger or hunger-related diseases. As many as 500 million more may die within a decade. Massive food shipments bring temporary reprieve for many on hunger's death row. But such generosity provides no long-term answer to famine.
For all intents and purposes, what most of us are really doing is just changing the location of the deck chairs on the Titanic. We're not doing something that is going to build a sophisticated low-technology safety net
When the bags of imported grain are empty and gone, the roots of the food crisis will remain. On soil which once provided subsistence for millions, large landowners now often grow only cash crops for export. Commercial farming practices frequently damage the soil. As population grows, trees that once held moisture in the earth are stripped for firewood, and deserts expand. At best, by the year 2000, there will only be half as much cropland per person on earth as there was in 1950. A quarter of the world's people are malnourished. How can they be fed? For years, agricultural experts have pinned their hopes on what is commonly known as the Green Revolution. New, more productive crop varieties have been developed at major laboratories like this one, the International Wheat and Corn Improvement Center, or CIMIT, near Mexico City. CIMIT is a high-tech seed factory. These miracle grains greatly improve crop yields. It's apparent in the thick rows of wheat and corn that surround the CIMIT laboratories. Since the dawn of the Green Revolution 4 decades ago, world grain productivity has more than doubled. But dark clouds loom over these fields, threatening the progress the Green Revolution has certainly brought. Higher productivity using miracle grains like these has come at high cost. 3 times more water, 7 times more energy, 10 times more fertilizer than was used in 1950.
I think biointensive practices are going to be much better in third world countries because they require less resources.
For 10 years, beginning in 1971, John Jevons tested biointensive methods at a garden site in a Palo Alto, California industrial park. Today, the work and research continue on steep slopes above Willits. In summer heat and winter rain, the gardeners try to improve biointensive techniques. Part of the biointensive method is deep digging. The soil is loosened by spade and fork to a depth of 2 feet, allowing the roots to penetrate vertically. The seeds or seedlings are planted much closer together than in commercial agriculture.
We have 4 times the plants in a given area. It's a deep soil preparation that makes this possible. You notice you can just sort of put your hand down into the bed because the soil is so soft.
When the plants reach maturity, they cover the entire bed, preventing rapid evaporation of water and discouraging weeds. Over the years, the Willits gardeners have tested more than 200 different crops.
We document all the inputs, the fertilizers and water that go into the bed, and we record all of the yields that come out of the bed.
The results, confirmed by independent university researchers, have matched early expectations. This garden produces 2 to 4 times U.S. commercial average yields for most grains and vegetables, while consuming only 1/4 as much water and fertilizer per pound of food produced. The gardeners use only hand tools and practices affordable in even the poorest of countries.
One of the fantastic things about biointensive techniques is that they're capable of producing Green Revolution yields, very high yields, without the special seeds, high water, and costly and high fertilizer inputs that are required by Green Revolution practices.
soil on this hillside is hard and poor, like that of most of the world's hungry nations. Garden-grown compost and organic fertilizers improve the soil, but the process takes time, and maximum crop yields are not achieved for several years.
It took us 7 years to build up our wheat yields. We started out at 3/4 the U.S. average, fairly low. And by 1979, in one test, we got at the rate of 5 times the U.S. average.
Healthy soil also makes plants more pest-resistant. Biointensive gardens don't use pesticides, but companion planting and natural predators help keep their crop losses lower than those of commercial farmers. When he isn't raising food, John Jevons is writing. His biointensive gardening manual, How to Grow More Vegetables, has been translated into several languages, selling nearly 250,000 copies.
Karen?
Former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Bob Berglund has been interested in biointensive farming for several years.
There's probably 1 billion people in this world who are malnourished. The Jevons approach could enable that segment of the population to feed itself adequately for the first time ever. That would be a remarkable development in this world and would do more to solve the problems of poverty, misery, and hunger than anything else that we've done.
The Peace Corps and UNICEF now use Common Ground publications for training agricultural volunteers. But many scientists still view biointensive methods as impractical.
Most agronomists are not skeptical about the yields that we're obtaining. They're skeptical about whether or not people will want to raise food manually. Right now you have people working very long hours, trying to find the money for very expensive inputs, and they're still not feeding themselves.
Though some experts still demand war proof, Common Ground research has generated interest from England to India.
Individuals and organizations in over 100 countries around the world are using our materials in over 4 languages right now. Major biointensive research and development projects exist in Mexico, India, China, the Philippines, and people seem to be grabbing hold of using the practice very readily.
When directors of an experimental project in Mexico wrote to Common Ground requesting an experienced biointensive gardener to teach the method, Gary Stoner had been a Jevons apprentice for 1 year. Gary volunteered to go to Mexico. Mexico City, the world's largest, with 18 million inhabitants. Like a magnet, the city attracts more than 1,000 people a day from the impoverished countryside. If present trends continue, 30 million people will live here by the end of the century. Many of them will live like this. Like most third world capitals, Mexico City is surrounded by the shanty towns of the poor. For thousands, home is a makeshift shelter in a garbage dump. Here, desperate people comb the city's refuse for life's necessities. Mexico was the cradle of the Green Revolution, but half its people remain malnourished. Dr. Jorge Martinez, Director of Family Services for Mexico, believes biointensive agriculture can help produce the food his country needs.
Does it grow naturally?
Martinez was very impressed when he first observed John Jevons' work 10 years ago in California.
In very short time, I was absolutely convinced of the need to do something similar in some place in Mexico. At that time, we have no idea of the possibilities of what we are doing here in Tula now.
Today, Dr. Martinez directs a program called Menos y Mejores, Fewer and Better. It's an effort to improve conditions in rural Mexico through family planning, nutritional classes, and biointensive gardens. At the request of Dr. Martinez, Gary Stoner moved to the village of Tula in northern Mexico to supervise the Menos y Mejores garden program. Change comes slowly in small towns like Tula, and the modern world of Mexico City seems far away. Yet many of Tula's people, like those of other small towns, dream of the capital. For despite its charm and color, Tula is a hard place to live.
La tierra es árida. The land is dry. It's not possible to grow things easily. It only rains 2 or 3 months of the year.
Poor land means poor food production and a poor economy. Malnutrition and health problems are common. For years, people have been leaving Tula to look for better lives in Mexico City or the United States. But the exodus may be ending, partly because of the highly productive gardens Gary Stoner is teaching people here to develop.
Quiero explicar un poquito hoy con ustedes el método de preparación de las camas que uso en mi huerto. ¿Cuántos de ustedes tienen huertos ya? ¿Usted, señor, tiene huerto? ¿Señor? ¿También? 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 Muy bien.
Each training session draws people eager to learn biointensive techniques. Biointensive gardening is also becoming popular.
People here are planting a lot. It takes no more than 1 hour in the morning and another in the afternoon. This is the first year I planted the garden, but it came out well. I think it really benefits us, especially the children. They're better fed and they don't get sick so often. The children like beets and radishes and carrots. And sometimes, if I'm not watching, they'll pull out the carrots and eat them right there. It's very necessary to have a garden for the children to be well nourished.
Many of these gardens were already producing when Gary Stoner arrived. But Gary provides technical advice that helps maximize crop yields. Deep digging in hard soil is difficult, and people often revert to easier but less efficient garden practices.
A lot of the people don't dig very deep, or they don't take off the rocks, and they don't get the same results. Or if they just throw in the plants without spacing them right, the yields are bad and there are more insect problems. We have to help them to learn how to use all of the parts together, and it's going to take some time.
Bio-intensive gardens still provide only a fraction of Tula's food.
I realize that the process of change and of making these changes are going to be a really gradual process, but it is happening. I've seen a lot of improvements here just since I've been here about 11 months. And for example, when the program started a few years back, many of these people didn't even know what a carrot was. And nowadays, the people who are using the garden and using it right are eating maybe 5 products a day out of the garden. And that's pretty significant.
Besides corn tortillas and beans, Families in Tula now receive the nutritional benefits of vegetables from their gardens.
Con la instalación de los huertos en las casas,
with their home gardens, people realize that they are beginning to eat better. This has definitely helped in reducing malnutrition here.
Eso ha contribuido definitivamente a que la desnutrición haya disminuido.
Dr. Gisela Lara is the Menos y Mejores coordinator in the Tula area. She says she's seen changes here that offer real hope for the future.
Little by little, people learn about gardens and health. Before, 30 or 40% of our children under 5 suffered from malnutrition. 90% of those children have now recovered.
In addition to his teaching, Gary Stoner cultivates an impressive demonstration garden on the grounds of Tula's hospital. He grows dozens of crops like carrots, sweet potatoes, collards, a leafy vegetable high in calcium, and sunflowers. This is amaranth, an indigenous and nutritious grain well adapted to dry climates. Cochia is considered a weed, but it produces nitrogen-rich compost. Lucia Garcia is a medical doctor, but she was so impressed by Gary Stoner's garden, she's changing her vocation.
It surprised me that these were such big and exuberant plants compared to the rest that grow in this area, because this is a desert. Such plants weren't supposed to grow here, but there they were, strong, healthy, and vigorous. So I asked Gary, how is this possible? And he explained it to me.
Armed with only a Spanish language version of how to grow more vegetables, Dr. Garcia began her own garden and encouraged other villagers to do the same.
The people were surprised to see me. How is it possible that the doctor is using a shovel? But this also motivated them. I think it's possible to reduce or even completely eliminate hunger if everybody realizes they can be self-sufficient in nutrition with family gardens.
Dr. Garcia believes the nutritional improvements these gardens provide are so important, she's leaving the medical profession to concentrate full time on spreading the garden idea.
I want to teach here first, so 100% of the families can grow these gardens and get the most benefits. And later, I want to go to other places if it's possible, and I hope that it is. For example, Africa.
Local enthusiasm like Dr. Garcia's has led Gary Stoner to sign up for another year of teaching in Tula.
John's kept me in touch with things that are happening back in Willits and with a lot of the new research they're doing in simplifying teaching people how to do the methods. And by showing the people the correct methods of bed preparation, of sowing the seeds, of transplanting the plants, and of caring for the plants, we can make a real difference.
Perhaps most importantly, the Tula Gardens have also caught the eyes of experts. Sam Taylor, U.S. Agency for International Development Director for Mexico, believes in the Green Revolution, but he says biointensive agriculture also deserves support.
It's probably not a panacea, but it certainly is a way to get people involved in improving their own well-being. It works. It works here in Tula. And if it'll work in Tula, it'll probably work anywhere.
Jones' approach needs to be tried on a large scale, in all regions of the world, and given a fair test. The Jones approach is never going to replace the Green Revolution on a commercial scale globally, but it certainly can fit an important part of the world's economy that is now being passed over by the commonly established systems.
The problems of hunger and food production have long been a special priority for Congresswoman Claudine Schneider. Schneider shares Bob Berglund's optimism about biointensive agriculture.
I feel very positive in that Jevons' approach is being used by the Peace Corps, and that we hopefully will incorporate it into our foreign aid bill, and the World Bank will incorporate it into their programs. Because only by taking this approach, I believe that we will be successful in helping Africa and other nations help themselves.
Back at Common Ground, work and research continue. New apprentices, like Louisa Lenz, learn the basics of biointensive food raising and prepare to begin their own projects.
So I should just kind of divide the bed down and
right, and sort of pretend like you're broadcasting seed. If you want to do it a little lighter, make sure you get it even.
On this damp spring day, John Jevons teaches Louisa how to spread organic fertilizer on a freshly dug bed.
Eventually, we hope not to use the organic fertilizers and use just compost that concentrates nutrients that are in the soil and makes them more available to the plants.
These visitors to Common Ground help support a biointensive project in Africa. Jevons shows them cover crops grown for compost. He hopes to create a self-sustaining food system with all soil nutrients coming directly from the garden.
We're building up the soil. We're helping create the proper diet for the soil. And as a byproduct, we get some food that, when it's grown in the right combination, provides a little better diet for ourselves.
Every tour of the garden ends in this circle.
It's like a circle of plenty. Right now, it would probably take 2 to 3 circles to grow a complete diet in. But we're convinced that soon it's going to be possible for one person to grow all of his or her own food on just one circle, 1,000 square feet. That's only 1/10 of what commercial agriculture grows a complete diet in.
The Common Ground Project is supported by sales of how to grow more vegetables, foundation grants, personal donations, garden produce, and a small mail-order seed business. Today, only a fraction of agricultural research funding goes to biointensive experiments.
My guess is that in 10 years, we're going to see a lot of public research spent on things that John Jevons has been doing by himself.
Another spring has come to Willits, and John Jevons is planting again. In his quiet way, he hopes to prove by example that biointensive gardens can feed the world.
But Jevons has kept the work up, and it's pretty amazing. There's an estimate now that something like 7 million people in Mexico are actually doing this sort of this particular gardening that started in that particular program. Gary Stone, a little bit, little add-on to the clear. Gary Stoner stayed for quite some time in Mexico. This is, he and the doctor were married. And actually, they now live in Minnesota. young doctor. And John Jevons is still working hard in Willits. He now has electricity, which they didn't back then. Everything was lamps and so forth. He has created in fact, the site is now, has many, many other things besides a garden. It's got a lot of solar development ideas and things, kind of a wonderful, amazing library collection of agricultural works that you can probably find nowhere else. And in the world. And a steady stream of apprentices come there from really all over the world on a continual basis and go back to their own countries and do this. And the book, which had sold 250,000 copies, I think we mentioned at that time, is now sold about 3 million copies worldwide. So it's very broadly used. Are there any questions on this one?
What's the title of the book again?
How to Grow More. It's got this very funny title. It's you'll see it in almost any bookstore under gardening. It's called How to Grow More Vegetables Than You Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Can Imagine. I was thinking of maybe using that as the title for the film. Then I figured it would take a full minute just to do the opening credits. So anyway, John Jones is a gardener. You know, his purpose is not to create titles. So.
How do you spell his last name?
J-E-A-V-O-N-S. And pretty remarkable guy. He didn't even, for the first 20 years of John's work, amazingly, he didn't travel. He stayed in his site and just worked day to day in testing, documenting literally absolutely everything documented, bringing in independent experts from the universities to confirm what he was getting in terms of his yields, what was going in, what was coming out, all of those kind of things, having them duplicate the results scientifically in their own plots at places like UC Davis, which by 1990 had established a sustainable agriculture program. And so that's one of the things that makes me very hopeful is that, you know, again, when I first met John, most people thought he was a nut. Really, not most people, but the top ag scientists, the Green Revolution folks, thought John Jevons was a loony, really. If you talk to them, you know, their idea that you could do anything like this without the chemicals and without the fancy hybrid seeds and all that was to them ludicrous. And I really believe that people don't feel that way anymore. They may certainly not feel this is, as Bergman said, this is any kind of panacea, but that really can, these kind of things really can complement other forms. And you go to all the big ag schools now, and they have sustainable ag programs, and they have a lot of interest in this kind of thing, and organic farming, and the students coming in study it. That's been in the last 10 years. It's been an enormous change, I think. Yes?
Where does he get his funding?
Well, he didn't get very much of it for quite a while, but he got it from some small foundations, primarily in the Palo Alto area. Some of it really came from the software, kind of high-tech industry people who just happened to be friends of his, because John was at one point the director of the systems analyst director at Stanford University, working on that. So he had a lot of friends in the high tech industry who gave some support to what he was doing. And you know, he was doing computer stuff, and actually went down and paid a visit, I think, around 1968 or 69 to the University of California at Santa Cruz, where an Englishman, former Shakespearean actor named Alan Chadwick, had developed a model garden using what Chadwick called the biodynamic French intensive method. And when Jevons saw this garden and what it produced, he thought, well, this is something that could really help solve hunger problems, and that's what Jevons was interested in. Chadwick was more an aesthetic guy, and he was interested in plants, sort of for the love of plants and making beautiful gardens. And his gardens were probably more than half flowers, for example, whereas Jevons is interested in food. And if you go, I just visited John Jevons in July at Willits, and
just to see all the changes and the number of crops that they grow and the ideas that they have about how to grow, what kind of combinations of crops both improve the soil at the same time as they increase the yields and all those things. It's amazing. It's very, very scientific. And I think it's because of that that it really has won over many of these people at the agricultural universities. Now, the second film is a story of something that may be kind of close to home for many people, because all of you may have these kinds of projects somewhere in your areas. And this is a story of another individual, kind of with a passion, and his name is Michael Abelman. He's written a couple of books, which you may have seen, one called From the Good Earth and the other one called On Good Land, which show, the first one, From the Good Earth, is a collection of his absolutely amazing photographs of traditional and organic agriculture all around the world. And the second one is the story of his own farm project in Santa Barbara, California, and the 20-year fight to save it from the developers, and that's the subject of this documentary. It's kind of about producing food locally and saving land so that you can do that. Michael Abelman has just moved to Salt Spring Island in British Columbia near Victoria, and is starting a big new garden project there. But this one is called Beyond Organic, and it was on PBS just this past spring. Meryl Streep is the narrator. It'll come on. I forgot to cue it.
Feed a lot of people on a very small piece of land using some time-honored practices.
I really wish that Sheikh Meese was located right next to Michael's farm, because it's very important that he's growing those vegetables for flavor, that he's taking care of the land for future generations, that he's thinking about my nourishment and my good health.
Only a generation ago, the Goleta Valley, just north of Santa Barbara, California, was still mostly farms and orchards. It's different now. All that remains of what was once an agricultural cornucopia is a 12-acre island in a suburban sea. It is a fragile but magical island, alive with the fragrance and colors of fruits and vegetables, with the sounds of animals and people. Time and again, this tiny farm has been almost lost to development, yet it has somehow survived and continues to prosper. Fairview Gardens has become a model of sustainable food production and an inspiration for thousands of people.
The hidden agenda behind a lot of our community efforts was very simply to get this community to identify with this land as if it was their own, and we were successful in that. The point was that if they identified with it in that way, that when the time came and the place was threatened, which I knew it would come, that people would rise up, and they did. Courage, carrots for the stand, four boxes, even though Stacy requested two, because tomorrow she'll ask for another two.
He came out about PK. So he said, well, I didn't.
Oh,
he didn't PK.
We're going to try to plant peppers.
It's 6:30 on an April morning. Time for work assignments at Fairview Gardens. Time to begin harvesting the dozens of different crops that are grown here. Time, too, to prepare the produce stand for the scores of customers who depend on this farm for at least part of their daily sustenance.
We're feeding 400 to 500 families, both through farmers markets, a community membership program, and produce stand.
It wasn't like that at all when Michael Abelman first came here.
20 years ago, there was 6 rows of peach trees. There was the original avocado orchard and a few little haphazard sections of row crops here and there. And certainly the land was not farmed as intensively, not even close to what we're now doing. I actually came to this land because I was asked to graft the orange trees over here. I was the local grafter in this county.
Back then, a young man named Chris Thompson was running the farm. Soon after Michael was hired, Chris left for another job. The owners of the land, an elderly couple with an interest in organic farming, asked Michael to manage it.
I don't have any formal training. Nobody really taught me how to farm. I was always the kind of person that read the directions after I used the product.
His education began with a morning walk.
My method of farming is based on what I consider to be the most important agricultural skill, and that is observation.
As he has most days since first arriving here, Michael Abelman traverses the farm from one end to another, looking carefully at his crops and taking notes.
After a while, you begin to notice the subtle changes that are taking place in the soil, in the shininess of the leaves of the plants, and the bark and the fruit. You look closely and you see what's happening amongst the insect life on the farm. And you learn an incredible amount in a 20 or 25 minute or half hour walk. People are constantly surprised at what little subtle thing I'm aware of in every corner of the farm. Because I have observed and walk this land day after day after day, watching the subtle changes and beginning to understand what happens. And because after a while, the plants tell you what they need.
Even on a little farm like this one, there is, of course, much more to consider than the proper care of plants. Like most small farmers, Michael had to learn how to repair old equipment and keep it running. That wasn't easy initially. The entire farm was undergirded with metal pipes. Through the years, specialized crops had been grown on the land. Each required a different irrigation system.
I found them all with the tractor. I ran into everything. I pulled up galvanized pipes with the rippers and the disc. I ran into valves. And that's how I discovered what was where.
In the early 1980s, urban sprawl discovered the Goleta Valley. Hundreds of acres of farmland were rezoned for residential development.
I began to see that the neighborhood was changing. That the Goleta Valley was no longer an agricultural region. I knew that if this place was going to survive economically, that we had to change our direction and our focus to appeal to the thousands of people that were moving in around us.
It was time to diversify. Michael and his crew began planting other crops.
Lettuce and broccoli and carrots and cabbage and potatoes and on until before I knew it, this place had been colored in with 100 different fruits and vegetables, incredibly diverse.
Buy the tasty organic produce being grown at Fairview Gardens and sold at several local markets. The farm began to prosper.
In the early days, we never talked about organic. We never used that word. we gave people a tree-ripe peach to taste. When we first started listening, some people would almost faint when they'd encounter a worm. And it took us a long time to educate people to the fact that the sign of an earworm is a sign that no poisons have been used.
Blessed with skilled co-workers who could help to run the farm, Michael was occasionally able to take time off and travel, especially during the winter. One of his first trips took him to mainland China.
What I saw completely blew my mind, really. There was this expanse, as far as I could see, this amazing network of fields of vegetables surrounded by waterways and pathways, all being worked by families working together in these fields. And this land was land that not only had been worked by these people's parents and grandparents, but by their great-grandparents and their great-great-grandparents, and in some cases all the way back to some 4,000 years. The same land. And I thought to myself, well, wait a minute, you know, how could these people maintain the same land for 4,000 years when we can deplete ours in this part of the world, in some cases, in a decade, in 10 years?
What began with a trip to China became, in succeeding years, a journey through five continents, camera in hand.
I had studied photography, but my photography was art for art's sake without any particular voice. I didn't have a story to tell. Suddenly, the photographer who had been dormant for so long and the farmer found a common voice. And I began photographing like crazy.
In time, his slides would become a book called From the Good Earth, filled with powerful images of land and people.
I was fascinated by what I had heard about what was going on in the Andes, in the mountains of Peru, where people were farming land that was so steep that farmers had been known to fall out of their fields. I witnessed fields of potatoes the size of most people's front lawn, with some 30, 40 varieties in a single field.
Such diversity, the farmers explained, helped keep pests in check.
I spent another winter in Africa, which was fascinating as well. I traveled to visit the Hopi in Arizona to see how a people could survive in really one of the harshest climates, often without irrigation water. And I began to develop this sense that there were some things that we could learn from these traditional cultures.
He brought along photographs of Fairview Gardens to show farmers in other countries what he and his colleagues were doing at home. On one excursion, he traveled with a companion through the wheat fields of Sicily. They were welcomed everywhere as honored guests.
It got to the point, quite literally, where everywhere we left with arms full of homemade pasta sauce in bottles, or olive oil, or wine, or bread, or cheese. And the car smelled like a traveling delicatessen. The poorer the people were, the more they offered you.
His hosts had few material goods, but they were rich in other ways, in their connections to the land, in their relationships to each other, in culture, tradition, and community. United States, Michael saw things less endearing. Vast acreage planted to a single crop, immensely susceptible to pests and disease, and protected only by floods of chemicals. Small farmers forced out of business, selling their land to giant conglomerates. Tasteless, uniform produce, packaged in plastic, and transported across continents. In the Central Valley of California, where 40% of America's vegetables are grown, he found a stark and silent landscape.
The first thing that I noticed was it was absolutely desolate. Where were the people? There were no families working the fields. I didn't see any birds. There were no insects buzzing. All that I could see were these flat fields, often with a single tractor, you know, maybe moving its way along.
Where, too, was the welcome he'd found all over the world?
They didn't want me there. I had to lie. I had to tell them that I was photographing for a school project in order to do what I was doing. The only people who entered those fields were people who had paid $1,000 to be led across the border and shipped like baggage to harvest and to hoe, period. Everything else was done by machines. I really responded in a very kind of, really in a very emotional way to what I was experiencing. After I saw what was going on visually, I felt driven to learn a little bit more about why it was happening and what exactly was happening.
The facts, gleaned from books and scientific reports, were no less alarming than what he'd seen. He learned that 46 acres of prime American farmland is converted to non-agricultural uses every hour. That California is losing topsoil at a rate 80 times faster than nature can rebuild it. That the average bite of food eaten in America travels more than 1,000 miles from field to plate, requiring an immense expenditure of energy. That pesticides poison 70,000 Americans and 1 million people worldwide every year, sometimes fatally. And that chemical agriculture is the largest source of groundwater pollution in the United States.
We pay less for food than any country in the world, but we're paying for it in our health, we're paying for it in the loss of topsoil, in the pollution of groundwater, and the people who are doing the work are paying for it.
Troubled, Michael Abelman looked elsewhere in the United States for signs of hope. And he found them in farmers markets, urban gardens, and other organic farms. There was a movement afoot all around the country, seeking a new relationship with the land and with food, and he was glad to be part of it. The farm grew increasingly productive and successful, finding new markets for its produce. But it was the calm before the storm. Farming is always a risky proposition. Too little rain or too much, an entire planting can be lost to a single cloudburst. But by the late 1980s, weather was the least of Michael Abelman's worries. Fairview Gardens was in danger. Almost overnight, the entire area adjoining the farm began filling up with houses.
It was really an assault. The construction would start at 7 o'clock every morning and would go straight through the day all the way till evening. There was dust everywhere. The noise was horrible, and it went on for months. They had 20, 25 different pieces of very heavy machinery over there operating all day long. It was like a war zone. That land next door was riparian habitat. There was tons of life, and there was deer and possum and raccoons and coyote and hundreds of different types of birds.
In a matter of months, it was all gone. Fairview Gardens was completely encircled by houses and strip malls.
Then the moving vans started lining up. The kids that moved in gravitated here. They started planting on our compost piles and building forts in the orchards.
But their parents began to complain.
They weren't used to living next to a farm. They weren't used to hearing roosters crow early in the morning. I did have a neighbor call, left me a message on my answering machine that said that he would rather look over his fence at condominiums and that the dust from the tractor was ruining the plaster in his pool.
At first, they were mad at compost.
Sometimes it would get a little smelly during the summer. A lot of flies flying around. So there was a time there that, you know, where some of the neighbors and myself would get upset about that.
I see the borders of the farm as extending beyond the edges of the fields. We provide the nourishment for the local community, and in turn, we should be receiving waste material being generated by the community. We should use that, recycle it.
His neighbors disagreed. They demanded that the piles be removed and got a letter from the health department ordering Fairview to stop composting.
I was threatened with jail time over that compost. What we did, though, is we invited all the neighbors over for a new relationship. And we served them a homegrown meal. And we talked about what their needs were, what we were trying to do here.
The neighbors agreed to let the compost compost. But a year later, the complaints resumed. Seems that some of the newcomers were getting less sleep than they'd been used to. They blamed the roosters, demanding their removal from the farm.
This proved to be a much more drawn-out, expensive battle. Eventually, there was a big hearing at the county, where the county officials suggested in all earnestness that we cut the vocal cords of the offending bees. My sister's a family court judge in the state of Delaware. Her comment was that if she, as a judge, is in the place of judgment on this case, she would recommend cutting the vocal cords of those doing the complaining.
For every neighbor who complained, another came forward to defend the farm.
That was really a neat place to go and visit when I first started going over there, because you can just walk around the farm and, you know, look at all the activities that are happening, and it kind of just draws you in immediately.
They got a lot of people out to the farm, and I think that's what started getting it in everybody's mind, that this was really a treasure that they had in the community that really deserved to be protected and taken care of.
The rooster riot, as the incident came to be called, brought a flood of supporters to a public hearing, and in the end, the county backed down.
Most people who have complained have actually come to appreciate us, often through their kids, who turn out to be the best ambassadors.
They come out here and run around the trees. They like to come and play hide and seek. And as long as there's not too many kids, Michael doesn't mind it. If they're real quiet and they're not doing anything they shouldn't be doing, if they're respecting the property, then he's okay with it.
How many of you have been on a farm before?
On an April afternoon, children from a neighborhood school come to visit Fairview Gardens. Together with their teachers, they are introduced to several of the crops grown on the farm.
Smell it and then pass it around, okay? How does that smell? Isn't that nice?
There is time for play, a chance to crawl through the asparagus forest. There's a lesson in the avocado grove.
Soil is what we depend on for our food and for our lives. Very important. Okay?
Every tour ends with a treat.
You have to be very careful so the carrots don't break. And we'll watch them for you right over here.
We hear from people all the time, "My children are eating vegetables."
Well, those kids have come out here. They know the people who are producing them. They see the fields where they're coming from. And they're eating food that was picked that day. So it actually tastes like something.
Each year, more than 5,000 people walk through this farm.
There are no fences that we've put up on the edges of the farm. There's no keep out signs. There are no pesticides being used. It's pretty much an open door policy here.
Signs throughout the garden allow for self-guided tours.
The more I spent time around the farm, I think the more Mike and I became encouraged to grow more stuff here at home.
And now even my youngest sister, who's an actress and a very flamboyant individual, is starting to grow plants and get bad hair.
They kept the compost, they saved the roosters, they reached out to the community through educational tours and public events, and their organic produce was increasingly popular. But by 1993, Fairview Gardens faced another threat, the most dangerous threat the farm had ever faced.
This place was zoned for 52 condominiums.
The owners of the land were under pressure to sell it to developers, and that would mean the end of the farm. There was only one way out. Michael and his colleagues would have to form a non-profit organization and buy the land themselves.
We had to raise $750,000. I didn't have a penny of it.
First, they needed $25,000 for an option guaranteeing that developers couldn't buy the farm before they raised the money.
Hello, John? Yeah, this is Michael Abelman calling.
Well, I made two phone calls. Calling up and ask someone for money. It's hard to do. First one said yes. We'll give you $10,000. Boom. The second one said yes. Give you $15,000. There we have it. We signed the option papers, the clock was running.
They have 1 year to find the rest of the money.
I realized I had bitten off a big chunk. There were people who told me it could not be done. And there were many nights that I woke up wondering how the hell we were going to pull this off.
But once again, local supporters of the farm rallied around it, raising money wherever they could.
We had wonderful people who came through and helped lead this effort and you know, went to their friends and to various foundations.
In 8 months, they raised $800,000, enough to purchase and preserve the farm as a land trust for future generations. On a Saturday afternoon in June, Enrique and Yolanda Correa, professional musicians from Oakland, stop by to visit the farm and offer an impromptu concert to the crew.
It's a fairly diverse network of people who are involved here. We have people from Mexico who are involved with field work. We've got interns, people who come all the way from Europe, from the East Coast, from the Northwest, to learn in a hands-on way what, you know, what we're doing, how we're doing it. When interns come here, I surprise them when I tell them that what I want them to do every day is to walk around with a small notebook and take notes of what they're observing.
He told us to write down what you're noticing from week to week. What does the tree look like this week? Is it producing fruit? Is it not? Are there insects on it? What, if so, what do they look like? I read Michael's book and it really inspired me to want to come here. And you never get a day off, but you're surrounded by all of this light all of the time. I'm getting a master's in environmental education, so it was good for me, for myself to find this, but also so I can teach children about it in the future.
I'm immersing myself in it. I want this to be part of my life, part of everybody's life, in a bigger way. I don't think that farming should just be something that certain people do and nobody else knows about. One of the best things is working out in the field with the Mexican workers, just practicing my Spanish. It's a lot of fun.
Para vender aquí, no?
He says that the ones that are red on top are good because we're going to sell them here, and the other ones are not because they're so hard. You could transport them to Chicago and sell them there.
the years, the farmers here have steadily increased their understanding of organic methods. Instead of using chemicals, they rely on natural predators and carefully nourished soil to help control pests.
If you don't sleep for 5 days straight, if you don't eat well, eventually you get sick. Plants are similar. If plants are grown in soil that is fertile, it's well balanced, they're grown at the right time of year, generally there are no pest problems. These are planted weeds, and they're planted not for our own nourishment, but for the nourishment of the soil.
Natural fertilizers keep the soil and the plants rich and healthy.
We plant a mixture of legumes before the winter rains. Legumes have the ability to fix nitrogen on their roots from this sea of nitrogen that we live in. We plant things like veg, and often peas, and fava beans. We get the advantage of all that organic matter, and we also get the nitrogen. That's one of the key practices that we have here, very important.
Yields per acre on this farm are about double those achieved by large-scale commercial growers using chemicals. One day, each week, members of Fairview Gardens CSA drop by to pick up their produce. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture.
People make that sort of a social contract with us. They agree to subsidize a portion of our farm budget in order to help us at a time of the year when we need income, the winter time. We use their investment to purchase seeds, tools, pay our labor costs and water and whatever else we might have to get crops going, so that by the time we begin our CSA season, which is in mid-March, we have something to offer to them. And then they reap the benefit of their investment throughout our 37-week season by coming and picking up their produce once a week here at the farm.
It's important to us to feel like we're part of the community, and of course it's really important to us that our children get pesticide-free food and as organic as possible. That means a lot to us as well.
We'll send you some stuff today. Okay, I can probably do that. And then whatever asparagus weekend is going to. Alright, thank you. Goodbye.
We have a marketing philosophy that has our food mostly sold locally and directly, which means that we try to sell it as close to the farm gate as we possibly can.
How far do you have to go back from Stroud to go to Washington State? What do you think? Florida, would you believe they grew in Goleta?
Even in the last 5 years, I've seen an increase in interest, not just in our food, but I think in organic food in general, and that helps a farm like us since we have been organic all these years.
After a decade of uncertainty, Fairview Gardens is finally safe, protected as a land trust and an educational institution called the Center for Urban Agriculture. The farm has become a model for others, from nearby schools to inner city neighborhoods. And people from around the world now contact Fairview Gardens for assistance in protecting their own farmland. But just as he did 20 years ago, Michael Abelman has new ideas about what this farm might become and how it might help change the world.
I believe that we need to go beyond organic. There are many large-scale organic farms whose labor practices are not so good, whose care of the soil is not so good, who are using the same industrial methods. Let's create an energy revolution in agriculture and learn how to farm without the incredible amount of diesel fuel and gasoline, and figure out ways to grow and to serve our local communities so that foods are not shipped these long distances. Large-scale organic farms began to adopt organic practices in the narrow sense of the word. We began eliminating the use of poisons. And I think we need to honor that. I think that's an important thing. It's a good step. But it's only the first step.
As the Fairview Gardens crew begins work on yet another morning, they have much to be proud of. in spite of many threats to its existence, this farm is still thriving, a symbol of a different kind of agriculture, in tune with the melodies of life.
So we got a few minutes left here if anybody has any questions regarding this one. Yes?
I'm just curious how that began. Did they approach you? Thank you for the film. First of all, did they approach you, or do you seek out him?
Actually, Michael approached me. He was in Seattle one day making a speech for this organization called TILF, the Seattle Organic, well, actually Northwest Organic Farming Group, and called me up, and he said that he wanted to, he was hoping to have a video done. Because he was giving speeches all over the country and he was tired of it. He wanted to just go back to farming, and he was tired of kind of doing this. And he had a slideshow that he took around, and you know, was always being asked to do it. And he tried to have it made into a film, but the people who kind of tried to make it into a film made a film that just sort of copied the style of the slideshow, and it didn't work very well. And he wanted to talk with me about it because he'd seen the Circle of Plenty and some other shows that I did. We had some friends in common. And so he came over to the TV station, and we talked about it, and we looked at his other tape and talked about what we would do differently. And the main thing I told him that I would do differently was to try to build a story of the farm and him and the sort of drama around the farm, and also his personal story into it, because before it was more just a slideshow and thing about here's the things we grow, and this is what's going on with agriculture, and this is what people are doing around the world. And I said, no, you know, that may be fine, but I think we really need to make a story out of it. We need to make your story because it's compelling. He was somewhat reluctant initially about that. He said, well, I don't really want the film to center on me. And I said, well, you know. And I hear that all the time. I mean, especially if you're sort of counterculture, you know, and you're, people don't, there's this sort of sense that, well, there aren't any leaders here, and we're all doing it, and we can't, like, stick anybody out front. And I understand that from the sense of being democratic and all that sort of thing. But I also think that certain people can kind of get a message across effectively, and that a personal story will help get that message across, that just coming up with 30 different people who all participate and say a word or two can't have the same impact. So I said, if I'm going to do it, this is the way we need to do it. And so he said, okay. And I said, so where are we going to? What he said, what will it cost to do this? And we came up with a budget. And he said, you know, what's the chance of getting this on public television? And I said, well, if the money comes from you, no chance, because it can't. That's just against the rules. The people who the program's about can't fund the program. So what he did was that we went out together and with a plan, and we raised the money from foundations, so that there. And Michael had to understand from the beginning that he wouldn't have control over how the show was gonna come out. He accepted all of that, so it was a wonderful person to work with. And when we got the show near completion, he had a friend who was a friend of Meryl Streep's. And Meryl Streep has been a big supporter of organic agriculture. And so the friend called Meryl Streep, and Meryl Streep said, oh, I love that book. I give it to people as Christmas presents. I'd be happy to do that. And so at no cost. She did it, and we talked about where we were going to do it, and I talked to her on the phone, and and she said, we're trying to pick a date, and so we came up with a date, and then she said, well, let's do it at Carnegie Hall. Carnegie Hall. Now this thing, you know, I may not have to pay Meryl Streep, but how am I going to afford Carnegie Hall? Well, it turned out that Carnegie Hall has a little recording studio, and it was no more expensive. In fact, it was slightly less expensive than virtually any other recording studio in New York, and Meryl Streep knew everyone there and could come in and do things all the time. So she said, you just call them up and you know, set the time and let me know the time. And so I called them up and said the date you wanted, and they go, oh, for Meryl Streep, we'll do anything. Sure, no problem, you know. And so Meryl Streep came sort of kind of hiding with stuff sort of draped like this, kind of slid into the place, and you know, walking through Manhattan streets not to be noticed. And she was just absolutely wonderful to work with, and funny, and she would like read a line in the script, and then she'd say, "Right on." Then she'd say, "You're gonna edit that out, aren't you?" No way, not with Meryl Streep leading. I'm gonna leave it in there. But she was terrific, and so we were fortunate to have that, and I think that added to getting the film on public TV, which we did.
So what's the update now on the progress of spreading this to the big, large agricultural?
I think there's just an awful lot more interest in local organic farming, and in these, particularly in this model called Community Supported Agriculture, the CSA model, which is a thing in which groups of people actually together support a farm. And you know, you actually put money in and to a particular farm, and you get a certain amount of produce. And so the consumer who's part of this CSA program is taking the risk with the farm. That is, if it's a bad year and weather destroys the crop, you're not going to get much in your supply. If the farmer does well and has a good year, then you get a kind of a bounty of stuff. But you're kind of taking that risk with the farmer. Those programs are multiplying by leaps and bounds, absolutely all over the country. I mean, it's at least in Seattle where I am, it is, you know, it is not at all difficult to be part of a CSA for farms that may be 50, 60, 70 miles, maybe right around the city. And of course, the closer they are, the better, but at least they're not 1,000 miles away. And they are helping, CSAs are helping small farmers stay in business. Plus, there's just so many more community gardens, and the community garden movement all around the country is big. In New York, Mayor Giuliani wanted to sell all the community garden spaces to bidders and to developers because to make money for the city. There was an enormous upsurge of protest against that, and he backed down on that. So the community gardens remain.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell them about Seattle's latest program of putting the fresh vegetables in the Meals on Wheels program? Are you aware of that?
I'm not. Why don't you tell them?
Okay. Well, we have farmers all over the area there that produce very good organic vegetables, in addition to the local farmers markets and the Pike Market that carry them on Wednesdays and Sundays, I guess it is, isn't it? But now what they've started is taking some of that produce and distributing it to the people who get Meals on Wheels. They get a package of fresh vegetables. Now, I wondered, if you get Meals on Wheels, how can you peel carrots and cook beans? But evidently, they try to give them fruits that they can eat fresh, you know, and so forth. And they're just delighted with it. And this is from a government grant that's done this. And that helps the farmers, and it helps the people with Meals on Wheels, too.
Well, that's great. I hadn't heard about that one, but I mean, there are a lot of these definite win-win situations, and I think it is becoming more popular, and it maybe will help to start turning things around. So we will grow more of our food in small farms that are close to where the people are who eat the food and so forth. I was personally inspired, obviously, by it, but I think a lot of people are.
If they have more produce than what those families need, what do they do then? Sell that and then they make that profit?
I think they can. They also sell stuff that's, surplus from what they provide. I think they try to guarantee a certain amount to the people. But can someone just shut down the projector? I think just for a good idea.
John?
Yes.
There's a CSA in Tacoma, the Guadalupe Gardens. And it's about 6 acres, and it's run by the poor and the homeless.
Oh, that's
and
great.
Students from different Catholic high school schools also come to help in it. And then the excess in that garden goes to support the Guadalupe House, which cooks for the poor and the homeless.
That's great. Are there a lot of these kind of creative ways of doing this? And you may find that this sort of thing exists in your community around your homeless as well, and we'll want to support it.
Yes? How does the cost to the consumer compare to the buy at the supermarket?
Well, organic produce is more expensive. There's no question about that. Places like Fairview Garden, and again, with a CSA, it kind of depends on how good a year the farmer has, so that you get more in a good year. But it's still more expensive because we aren't paying the real cost of food for commercial agriculture at this point, and the cost to health and soil and all these other things aren't yet part of the bill. And there are people working to change that as well. There's a lot of interest in this country around issues like ecological taxation, for instance, that would attempt to make prices and make the market reflect the real costs of things that now simply get passed on sort of to all of us. And the facts and things like that, we all pay, and we're all paying in the rising cost of health care and those kind of things. But it's still more expensive, but I think it's starting to come down. And clearly it's a question of the more demand there is and the more supply and the more farms doing it, the more the price will come down.
Quick comment, I think. I'm one of the food service coordinators here, for those of you who don't know me, but we have this year particularly taken huge jumps in buying organic and local from some farms that we have pretty direct relationships with. We're not CSA size, but that's the sort of relationship we have going, and it's working really well. And surprisingly, our food choices end up making it affordable. If you have a lot of fresh vegetables and stuff around, that's what you eat, and you're not eating some of the prepackaged stuff. And we've been really surprised that our budget is still, as far as I know, not changed tremendously. It's kind of something that we didn't
really
expect,
good.
But it's working better. I also lived in a community in Tacoma who did buy from Guadalupe Gardens. And it's a nonprofit. We don't have a lot of money, but again, by making the choices to do that, you can change other things sometimes, and it works.
That's a really good point. And of course, some of the things about being local, and that there's reduced energy costs and packaging costs and preservation costs and all those kind of things. So I think in the long run, that you're going to see these things coming closer together, but right now, I mean, when in general, organic food is still higher. And I should say that Michael Abelman is a person who doesn't necessarily say that organic is what's absolutely the best. In fact, he says that he would prefer that people buy locally from small farmers and from people who treat their workers decently and such, even if those people use a limited amount of chemicals in integrated pest management programs and things, that if it's a trade-off between that and a huge distant organic farm, of which there are some, and where the farm workers are still receiving their rock bottom and so forth, Michael says he would buy the food that had been sprayed a little bit. You know, that all these things are trade-offs, it's not absolutes, and I think we all have to think about and that's what the idea is about being beyond organic. It's that there are many factors to consider in our food, not just whether or not chemicals are used. And also, shifting away is an important thing. It's not just being immediately organic, but if we can get all of our small farmers to just begin to start reducing, and they are. I mean, I think it is there are integrated pest management programs and other things that really are starting farmers to see that they can do with less chemicals. And hopefully we'll go in the right direction. So I'm optimistic about this, and in spite of the fact that we still have a tough row to hoe, I guess, to put it in agricultural terms. Anyway, happy to talk to anybody afterwards, but thank you all.